Hi, I'm Daniel Lenzian, host of Western New York Soundstage, from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios. Western New York Soundstage is a podcast that looks to explore Western New York's creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. On today's episode, we have author Robert Bright, who is an expert on the Gilded Age and writes historical fiction based in the Buffalo-Niagara region, in his acclaimed works, including the Avenging Angel Detective Agency Mysteries. His newest book, Current of Darkness, the third in the series, is now available wherever books are sold. More information about his books and his research on Buffalo's Gilded Age is available at robertbrightonauthor.com. In this interview, we talk about his realizations working as a speechwriter, his incredible research process, the power in reading text aloud, and the joy of revisiting characters. I hope you enjoy my interview with Robert Brighton.
So, Robert Brighton, thank you so much for chatting with me today. How are you?
I'm very well. It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me today.
Fantastic. So I always like to start off my interviews by asking, is there a story from your youth that connects you to the work you do now?
Yes, as a matter of fact, there is. I owe my entire writing career and my enthusiasm for history in general to a fellow I never met by the name of Mordecai Manuel Noah. And Mordecai Manuel Noah was a New York City playwright, Tammany Hall political boss, and a very early utopian. And he devised the idea of what he called the City of Refuge for the Jews on Grand Island, New York, adjacent to Buffalo, which is one of the places I happened to grow up. And the city was never erected. The idea just met with more or less ridicule, and Mordecai Noah went back to New York to run the Tammany Hall machine and his regular life. But he left behind in 1825 a cornerstone for the city. It said Ararat, a city of refuge for the Jews. And it has the line written in Hebrew here, "O Israel, the Lord God is one," and so on. Well, anyway, as it turned out, when I was a kid, this stone, this cornerstone, which is kept in the Buffalo History Museum, was loaned to the Grand Island Public Library. And as a kid, probably from the time I was about seven, when I was old enough to start bicycling to the library myself, I would go up to the library, I would sit in front of the cornerstone, and I would dream. And I would imagine what a city of refuge would be like, and what a utopia would be. And I don't know, it just, there was something about it, sitting in front of that stone, looking at it hours and hours on end, that made me want to write stories.
You know, I always think I'm so glad that I was able to grow up when I did, because there was a time where we could sort of allow ourselves to almost like be bored and force sort of our imaginations to work, right? Like, I wonder now if people are still able to sort of look at a stone and dream, or if the sort of, I don't know, delicious temptation of removing the phone and sort of Googling something overwhelms that kind of ability just to sort of sit with something.
That's a really, really interesting observation. I mean, I have a view on it. I too am happy I grew up when I did. The way I grew up would appall most parents today. I was out on my bicycle, you know, most of the day by myself, or maybe with a few other friends who were in as much trouble as I was. No helmets, no pads, none of that. But I think that to a greater or lesser degree, humans have really become already become cyborgs. They don't rely on their memories. They don't rely on their imaginations, because the phone or the iPad or whatever device supplies that in greater quantity and with greater speed and with a lot less suffering. And I think education and learning, and certainly writing, involves suffering. None of those things is easy, or should be easy for that matter. And so, I'm of the opinion that imagination and intellectual independence are very much on the wane by being a now what I think of as a connected species.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. No, it's very true. I mean, I have to say that in looking at your website, talking about imagination, your website is a sort of fascinating collection of writing and articles and almost this like wonderful collage of a life. And in your bio on your website, all of these things are alluded to, like opium dens, or it almost makes you sort of feel like or seem like an Indiana Jones. You're a kid that grew up in Buffalo. You seemingly left Buffalo and spent some time in France. Can you tell us a little bit about the life you had directly after Buffalo and maybe how some of those experiences inform your writing?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Growing up in Buffalo was delightful in almost every way. I would say the only thing that I yearned for, and I obtained through books, really, which fueled my love of, or fired my love for reading, of course, was adventure. You know, I Buffalo is a relatively small place. I guess I would read Roy Chapman Andrews and books about, you know, across Mongolian plains, and I just dream about doing that sort of thing. And when I graduated college, I went to college for mechanical and aerospace engineering. And I think I wanted something that where there was an actual answer. Like the nice thing about science, you know, or I should say applied science, let's put it that way. Applied science is there's an answer, you know, like either the metal is thick enough to hold up this bridge or it's not. So I kind of like that. There's a part of me that still likes that. But I got out and I found out the practice of engineering was, to me, deadly dull. And I started casting about for some other opportunity. And I don't know how I landed it now, through the luck, I suppose, really, which is the story of most of my life anyway. But through luck, I landed a job as a speechwriter for some of the executives at DuPont Company in Wilmington, Delaware. So I was at the corporate headquarters, and this is all going to get to the point. Trust me.
No, I'm fascinated.
So I was a speechwriter. I was a 24-year-old speechwriter. You know, kind of on the fast track. You know, I was talking to the CEO of DuPont. You know, in those days, CEOs, you didn't talk to CEOs until you're 50s probably if you did then, if you did at all. And so I was flying high, but one day I had an experience that changed the course of my entire life. And that was, I was on my way to work as usual, weekday. And I was on the eighth or ninth floor of the DuPont building. I forget which, but one of the top floors. And, you know, I always want to take the stairs instead of the elevator. That's probably, there's a metaphor in that, but I really literally wanted to take the stairs instead of the elevator in those days, especially. So I was walking up these wonderful stairs inside the DuPont building. It's an Art Deco building. Even the stairs are all marble, you know, it's beautiful. And what I noticed as I was trudging up the stairs to the ninth floor was that these hard marble stairs had been worn, that they had a dip or a divot worn in them by the passage of countless feet, innumerable feet going up and down these same stairs over, you know, 70 years, I don't know, however long it had been around. And it hit me with the force of an epiphany that I was just another pair of feet wearing my tiny little grain of marble away up and down those stairs. And I thought, that's not the way I want to live my life. I want to live my life in a way that's fundamentally different. And if it's a big mistake and I'm wrong about all this, well, it'll at least be my mistake. And so I got to the ninth floor. By the time I got to the ninth floor, I had resolved that I would sell everything I had, quit my job, and travel around the world with a backpack on my back. And that's what I did. I got to the ninth floor. I resigned effective 2 weeks. I sold my car. I sold all my stuff. I put what I had left in a backpack. And I left for 2 years to wander around the world. And it was that experience that I guess filled in, some of the more provincial gaps in my experience of the world, you know, from growing up in Buffalo. And it taught me, I suppose, that One can do almost anything one resolves to do if one is willing to take a chance. As someone once said, leap and the net will appear. And it was that moment when I learned to leap.
How did writing come in after that? I mean, surely you're collecting stories and seeing things. Where did the inspiration to become a novelist come in?
I started writing a book. One of the countries I visited when I was traveling, I went to then Burma. Now they call it Myanmar or something like that. The junta calls it that. So I still call it Burma. Anyway, I went to Burma, and there was something so evocative about Burma that I started writing a novel about Burma while I was traveling. It was the first time I tried to write any meaningful amount of fiction. Well, it wasn't very good. I still have some of the pages. It's actually quite terrible, which is to be expected, by the way. Writing is an art, but it's probably even more a craft, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of doing it badly to start doing it well. But anyway, I wrote this book, and I started to fancy that I wanted to be a writer. And that's when I decided I wanted to go and learn the French language. And so I got some books in French and a dictionary. And as I was traveling around the world, I would read these books and look every word up in the dictionary. And, you know, literally 100% of the words I was looking up. And then it was 95%, then it was 90, then it was 80. And by the time I got to France, I passed the entrance exam for the Sorbonne. And I got into a graduate level French literature course, series of courses. And it was in those classes trying to write well in a foreign language that I determined that if I can write reasonably well in French, I can do very well in English if I only train myself. And that was the beginning of a very long self-training program. I never went to school. I had freshman English. That's the only English course I've ever had, writing course I've ever had in my life. So I was, in that as well as a lot of other things, an autodidact. And when I got back to the States after I ran out of money on this trip, I just literally ran out of money. I had enough for a plane flight back. Came back to the States, and I got a job at the National Research Council editing a magazine. So that was my first foray into being, I guess, or into earning my living with my pencil. And then it just seemed like whatever I did in my career after that, the differentiator for me was, I could usually write and communicate a little bit better than the next person. And it turned out to be a very, very valuable career skill, as well as a great training ground for fiction. But I wasn't a full-time fiction writer until half a dozen years ago. I just decided that, while I had done a lot of writing in business and some for fun, I just got to the point where I thought, if my whole life passes by and I've never really tried this, I think I would feel the same way I felt when I was walking up those stairs in the DuPont building, that I had somehow squandered the most precious gift of all, and that's the gift of time, the gift of our lives, the fact that we get to be in this world. The universe is indifferent. It went on for eons before I got here. It'll go on for eons after I'm gone. So in the little time that I'm here, I want to make the most of it. And so I left the business world where I had been for quite a while and started writing full time.
Wow. Where did the inspiration for the series of books that you've written that are all set in Buffalo come from?
I decided that I wanted to write books, or at least one book. I didn't know what was ahead at that point, but half a dozen years ago, I decided I wanted to write a book that was set in the very late Gilded Age. The Gilded Age, like 1870 to, some will say, literally the end of Queen Victoria's life. In 1900, but I stretch it to like maybe 1905, because I still find the world in 1905 was much more like the 19th century than it was the 20th. I mean, starting with World War I, it's really, we recognize the modern world emerging in all of its horror. So anyway, I got fascinated with the late Gilded Age, And I decided that the best way to learn about the Gilded Age, since I couldn't sit down and talk with anybody who lived then, was to get as close to all the original sources and voices as I could. So I began collecting letters and diaries, and I started sitting down and reading old newspapers. So I picked three Buffalo newspapers and one New York City newspaper, and I read them from 1898 to 1902, so 4 years or whatever. I read every one of them cover to cover. I mean, articles, op-eds, ads, comics, whatever. I read all that newspaper cover to cover. It took 4 years. And by the time I was done, I had really been steeped in sort of the vernacular of the time, and I knew what felt like it would be authentic at that time. Now, newspapers and diaries and letters, one could argue, are not entirely representative of the whole span of human experience at the time, of course, and I would be the first guy to agree with that, but I still would say that it's the closest we're going to come. There are no eyewitnesses, and eyewitnesses are notoriously unreliable anyway. So when you look at, you know, four newspapers, and especially in those days, you didn't have one newspaper with one political point of view or one social point of view. Buffalo had as many as 13 newspapers at one time in that epoch. And so these four newspapers plus the New York newspaper gave me a pretty good smattering of information. Anyway, long story short, I finished the 1902 newspaper. I was really sad when I finished reading the last page of the last newspaper in 1902. And I thought, oh, geez, you know, I got to stop this research and get serious about figuring out what's right. And then I decided that I would, oh, hell, I'm just going to read a couple more months. You know, 1903, I'm going to open up 1903 and do a few more months. So I get to February 1903, and I trip across quite by accident the biggest unsolved crime in all of Buffalo's history. And it has so many layers. It has incredible human dimensions. It has implications for government, shall we say, malfeasance. It has everything. Plus, it has a locked room mystery buried in it. And no one ever solved it. No one. So I resolved that my first book, The Unsealing, would be the solution, fictionalized, of course, the fictionalized solution to this famous case. Well, I needed a detective. And so I don't know how these things happen, but Sarah Payne, who's my heroine and lead detective for the Avenging Angel Detective Agency, which is the series that I've got going, just sort of knocked on my door one day and announced herself and inserted herself into this project, and all the characters have done that to me. So anyway, that's where it all came from. Now I'm writing standalone books too, so it's not just a series, and I specifically designed the series so that people don't have to start at the beginning and read them all in order. You could drop in anytime, they're all freestanding. You'll be rewarded if you start at the beginning because you have a deeper understanding of the long arc of these characters' lives, but at the same time, you don't have to. Anyway, that's where it all came from. So again, serendipity, kismet, spiritualism.
Yeah, there is something. I mean, I do think that inspiration works that way. Even, you know, if we think about kind of like the root of it, to be inspired is literally to take the spirit inside.
To take a breath.
Yeah, yeah, it's yeah. My students, you know, inspiration and inhalation are directly related.
As a former Latin student, I applaud you for saying that. Yes.
Thank you. The Avenging Angels Detective Agency series are working within the mystery genre of books. A couple months ago, not to sort of be reductive, but this is leading to a question. Right? There's so much more than that, right? But Tim Carroll, who is the artistic director of the Shaw Festival, and I had an interview a couple weeks back, and he said that a genre piece, and I'm paraphrasing him, a genre piece allows us to see the craft and skill of an author, right? Because when you know that there's a mystery at the center of something, we sort of are understanding, we have genre expectations around that. I'm interested to know, what have you learned about mystery or writing mysteries while working on your novels?
Probably very little. This is where being entirely unschooled and untutored I think has been a boon. I write my own notion of mystery novel. Sometimes, actually, everyone knows who the culprit is from the first page. What I'm particularly interested in is all of the levels of human inquiry and obfuscation along the way, you know, and how people protect themselves and protect their interests, even if they're guilty as hell. So, you know, it's kind of a funny thing. Like I, for instance, I don't think I've read any fiction since about 1930. I don't mean that I was alive in 1930, but I mean written since 1930. Okay. And I avoid it entirely because I don't want to be influenced even subconsciously in any way. I don't want to pick anybody else's, I don't want to pick up anybody else's cadences, their vocabulary, their way of approaching a story. Again, back to what I said earlier, I've always believed if I'm going to make mistakes, however horrible, they will be my mistakes. And so I will say that I don't really know a hell of a lot about what makes a good mystery. I just try to write the best mystery I have in my head. And so far, people seem to like them. And they are a little bit different from a lot of mysteries. They don't follow, for instance, I shouldn't criticize her because she is, after all, the master of detective fiction. But, you know, Agatha Christie, for example, you know, I find the stories very contrived. You know, there are 12 suspects. They're all equally whatever. And then what happens at the end, they're all in a room and you know, Hercule Poirot says, "Yes, you little question says that you, Mr. von Neumann, are the killer." And then von Neumann goes, "Oh, you got me, Poirot! Dry blast!" And he runs out of the room and, you know, "Damn you, man!" You know, and then, of course, the cops go, yeah, like, really? I mean, does that ever, ever happen in real life? And so my mission in these books, not just the series, but my standalone books, is to bring the Gilded Age to real life, to help people experience it as it was. And in many ways, it was profoundly different from our age, but in many ways, very similar, because humans haven't changed. I mean, we're the same species we were 120 years ago. We have the same likes and dislikes and loves and lusts. Well, maybe the targets of those likes and lusts and dislikes have changed over the years, but we still behave in the same way. And so there's both something very strange and familiar about the Gilded Age. And I want people to take my hand and wander around in it. But whether it looks like anybody else's work or, you know, whatever, I don't know.
No, I think that that's great. And I was sort of interested, and I think that you sort of talked about your relationship to genre in your answer, right? And sort of, you know, conjuring the name of Agatha Christie and saying like, what you're trying to do is maybe divergent from that, right? In the sense of like, we don't have to work with a formula and we can play within genre and really kind of give a wonderful sort of really human story. And even just sort of your allusion to what actually happens versus the neat and tidy setup.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, yeah. And look, I loved Agatha Christie when I was a kid. I mean, I want to write books that people feel are real. I mean, that they get to know the characters. They can almost, I mean, the one person that did a review, a reader, it wasn't a professional reviewer, but one person did a review on Amazon of one of my books said, it's almost as if we're sitting on the shoulders of these characters walking around and observing everything. I can't tell you how gratified I was to read that. I mean, that's what I want. You know, I want people to feel like this is as real an experience as, well, their own lives, their own real lives.
Well, and if people pick up your latest book, The Current of Darkness, I think they'll feel that. Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Yeah, I hope so. Current of Darkness is a tale of industrial espionage set in turn of the last century, Niagara Falls, and also in Buffalo. And it's the story of two very, very determined women who are at once friends and mortal enemies. You know, they've crossed swords in the past, these two women, but they both have something in common, and that is they're representative of what might have been called back in the day the new woman movement, or, you know, we'd call it maybe first wave feminism today. But the New Woman simply said that women were capable of much more than society allowed, and that they should have equal opportunity for, you know, jobs and for everything else that, that men had. Okay, it seems like a fairly innocuous notion to us now, but it was revolutionary at the time. And my two heroines, Sarah Payne and Alicia Miller, are very much the New Woman, representatives of the New Woman. So Sarah started a detective agency because she's felt that justice is too often denied to people because of corruption in the government or because of imperfections in the justice system itself, whatever, other imperfections. And Alicia Miller, her husband was murdered, and he tried to disinherit her because she was fooling around with somebody. And she's just decided that the new majority owner of her husband's firm is a buffoon and that she can do a much better job of running the show. And so she throws herself into the world of business. And both of these ladies find themselves in worlds that were really, quote unquote, men's worlds at that time. I find that notion fascinating. And it's not super far-fetched because, you know, everything that we've seen in the way of women's rights expanding over the years, you know, had to start with a few pioneers. So I think these ladies are pioneers. And the men are interesting. They're not stock figures. They're not from central casting. They have their goods and bads, as do the heroines. The ladies are not all like sunshine and roses either. You know, they can make terrible decisions. They can be mean. They can be petty. They can be everything that humans can be. And yet, there's a nobility about them, I think, that they are daring to be something more than people either think they can be or wish to allow them to be.
I picked up a copy of it and I started reading it, and I think it is wonderful. And what I love about it is sort of that when you dive into the book, you are really brought into, it's not necessarily a different world, right? Because it is still the world of Buffalo, but the environment is so clear and specific. It really feels like you can just dive into the world of the book, which I think is amazing. I also sort of, you know, kind of, we were talking earlier about my job as a professor and stuff like that. It was a book that I really enjoyed reading out loud because the language is so evocative, and it's just like something that you could just sort of read out loud, and because the language is so powerful.
Well, that's awfully kind of you to say. I mean, you're a legit literature professor, so I thank you. And that's a high compliment. Yeah, funnily enough, I learned that trick when I was a speechwriter. Because when you're a speechwriter, you have to get not only the topic right and the facts and all that, but you have to find the voice of the person giving the speech. And the only way I could do that, I found, again, but just empirically by making mistakes, was by reading the speech out loud.
Yep.
And so I read all of my novels out loud because there's no better way to find language, especially in dialogue that just sounds phony or, you know, it's just over the top, lush or whatever it is. I mean, so I read them all out loud, and I'm glad to hear that that extra bit of effort is paying off.
Definitely. This is not Sarah Payne and the Avenging Angels Detective Agency's first adventure. What is it about the Avenging Angels that makes you want to return to them?
They're lovable people that you want to spend time with because their hearts are in the right place, but at the same time, they don't quite know what they're doing. Like there's a certain charm about them. Like they're people you can relate to. Like, can I really, I'm going to go back to Agatha, sorry.
Yeah.
But can I really relate to Hercule Poirot? No. I mean, it's by design. I mean, by design, you can't relate to him. He has a little bit of cells. I mean, he's superior. Sherlock Holmes, can I relate to Holmes? I hope not. But the nice thing about the Holmes stories is they've got Watson. You can sort of relate to Watson. He's more like a regular guy, but he's smart. I mean, he adds his piece. My point is simply this. My characters, I think, are people that have extraordinary gifts in some dimensions, but also are very ordinary people in many others. They're people that you would want to get to know. They're people you'd want to spend time with. They're people you'd want to maybe learn from. And there are some things that they could probably learn from us. So I think the charm of the Avenging Angels detective agency lies in the fact that they are very real people, and warts and all, and they're people that, you know, my readers seem to want to keep learning about as they go.
I heard another interview with you too, where because of the meticulous research you do about Buffalo, you have received emails from people saying things like, oh, I really hope to kind of walk in these footsteps and see, like, you know, the places that exist in Buffalo. So it's real people in a real city in places that still sort of really exist.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're very fortunate in Buffalo that so much still exists. I mean, a lot is gone, a lot, but still, relative to most American cities, America's funny. I mean, compared to, like, say, Europe, you know, America, when buildings get old, you know, they just get knocked over and turned into parking lots and stuff. Certainly happened in Buffalo. But, you know, ironically, the fact that Buffalo was in such a long period of economic decline, you know, gave people no economic incentive to knock over some of these wonderful Gilded Age buildings that still exist and places that still exist and can transport us into another time. So, yeah, and my publisher sent me emails from, you know, like Australia and Switzerland and a couple, you know, several other countries where people are planning to bring the family to Buffalo because they'd never heard of Buffalo before. If you're living in Basel, Switzerland, I don't know, why would you? But they're coming to Buffalo, and it's pretty cool because in June I'm giving a walking tour downtown, associated with my book, The Buffalo Butcher. So it takes place in what remains of Buffalo's Tenderloin District, the Red Light District. So while a lot of that has been replaced over the years, there are still a lot of really old buildings that were brothels and saloons and everything else in this giant Red Light District in downtown Buffalo. So we could actually go and touch history as well as talk about the book.
That's fantastic. Please let us know when that event is, and I'd love to include it in the biweekly calendar just so people can join you.
Great. It's actually going to be June 8th. There'll be one or two sessions, and it's in conjunction with No Illusions Tours, which is a tour company in Buffalo.
Awesome.
They're having me as a special guest. So yeah, I will keep you posted on it. I think registration will start around the end of this month, but it should be a lot of fun.
I have one final question for you, and yeah. I'd love to ask it. If your book was being read by a book club, and I really hope that it is, or any of your books, right? Buffalo Butcher or Current of Darkness or any of the other Avenging Angels series, what do you hope the conversation is about?
That's a very, very, very interesting question. I would say I would love for people to talk about my characters and how they influence one another, how they are influenced by their society, and how they make change happen in their lives and in their society as a whole. Because I guess I just have this deep belief. I alluded to it when I said about women's rights. I mean, it has to start with one. It has to start with a few pioneers. But I have this deep belief, and I guess it's just played out throughout my whole life. I've been very, very lucky because it seems like, you know, the more I try to do, the more I find I can do. And I think I'm not so different from other folks. And we all have tremendous untapped potential. And it's just a question of whether we have the courage and luck and opportunity to tap it. But I hope people will talk about that sort of thing in reflecting on my characters, because I really think they're all to the best that they are able, trying to be the most fully dimensioned person that they can be in their lives. So I hope people enjoy that. I love these characters. I know them. I know everything about them from birth to death. It just so happens I'm writing about a particular point in their lives, and I'm dropping in on them, and I'm bringing people with me. And I hope they'll find these folks as interesting as I do.
Thank you very much. Those are my questions, but I always like to end an interview by saying, is there anything that you feel was left unsaid or anything you'd like to share with our listeners before we get going?
I really enjoyed your questions as to being things that are left unsaid. I guess that the only thing I would say, or certainly my publisher would want me to say, is what's next, what's coming next. Current of Darkness is just out, but I'm not stopping. I'm going to keep writing until I can't do it anymore. So the next book that will be out in September is called The Phantom of Forest Lawn, which takes place in and around our beloved Forest Lawn Cemetery in Buffalo, coincident with that cemetery's 175th birthday. And it is a novel of love and grave robbery. And so I think it's both, a little bit, it's spooky, it's poignant. And I think if anybody who's listening or watching this has ever truly loved someone, they'll find this story one they have to read.
Thank you. I'm so excited to get it when it comes out.
Well, that's very kind of you, sir.
Thank you.
I'm honored that you would have me on your podcast, your show.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It was amazing talking to you. I will include all of the links in the episode notes and in my intro and outro, but it was really excellent speaking with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you kindly. I appreciate it a lot.
It was great chatting with Robert Brighton. I hope you pick up a copy of Current of Darkness, and I will definitely be looking for The Phantom of Forest Lawn this fall. This episode was produced by Jessica Marinelli. Addison Schoonmaker engineered this episode. In addition to this podcast, you can check out our local event guides posted bi-monthly on buffalorising.com. Make sure you subscribe to the show. If you like the show, please recommend it to a friend. Thanks for listening to Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios.